On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Strip all the way. Lift, spread, squat, cough for very close examination. It sounds harsh, demeaning, but this week, that is what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled as fair play, constitutional, for anyone arrested for anything, however minor. If you go to jail even for a minute for an overdue parking ticket, a noisy muffler, a bicycle with a broken bell, a dog without a leash, you can now be stripped and searched even with no reasonable suspicion of anything out of line. The High Court said in a 5-4 decision that we need the search to keep jails safe and secure, but many are still wondering about dignity and rights. This hour On Point, the stripped, searched American citizen, you can join the conversation. Does this add up to you for security? Is this what it means to be an American citizen, stripped and searched on no reasonable suspicion? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. In a moment, we'll hear from two big legal scholars on the weight and implications of this decision. But first, joining me now from Fort Lee, New Jersey, is the attorney who represents the man whose strip search brought the case to the High Court. Attorney Susan Hanna Lask represents Albert Florence, the petitioner in Florence versus Board of Chosen Freeholders of the County of Burlington. She was right there in the court this week. Susan Hanna Lask, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us what happened in the first place in this case? How did Mr. Florence come to be in jail?
It started quite a while ago, about 7 years ago, when he was stopped on a minor, a routine traffic stop. His wife was driving their SUV, and basically they said that the state trooper said there was a warrant for his arrest. Let me make clear, the warrant says to bring him to a magistrate. It doesn't say bring him to a jail. In any event, they bring him to Burlington County Jail, and the warrant was for a apparent fine, a court fine that wasn't paid, which is a non-criminal offense, something similar to a traffic ticket. You know, it's just not a criminal offense. It's not a misdemeanor. It's not a felony. And he was brought to Burlington. He was strip searched there.
So he had been out driving when he was on his way to his parents' home with his wife and their little boy.
Exactly. Actually, his wife was pregnant,
okay,
and he also had a little boy in the car.
Okay.
Right, and they saw his dad, you know, thrown to the side, taken away, cuffed, and
his dad, who had not even been driving, just been sitting there. The computer said he hasn't paid this fine, so bring him in. Now he arrives in the jail.
To a magistrate, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
To a magistrate.
To a jail, okay.
Which is interesting.
Okay.
And basically, as we all know, it was a computer error, in fact. He paid the fine a long time ago. It was paid, and he actually had the proof of payment on him. He showed it to the state trooper, but they wouldn't accept it. He showed it when he was processed. Now, you know, remember, this is all about processing at the point of processing intake. And at intake, he showed that, and nobody would listen to him.
Okay.
Why no one brought him to a magistrate immediately and kept him for 7 days and strip-searched him twice?
Wait, he was kept for 7 days?
Yes, he was. He was in Burlington for 6 days. By the seventh day, he was taken, finally picked up by Essex County, where the improper, you know, false warrant originated from. And that is where he finally saw a magistrate, and the magistrate realized it was a computer error and let him go after going through quote-unquote hell.
Just so we understand this, Mr. Florence, he's there with his pregnant wife and their little boy. They're on their way to his parents' house. She's a little bit over the speed limit. The cop pulls him over, and pretty soon he's in jail. Now, this is not that it should matter. Everybody's got their rights, absolutely. But this is like not a drifter or something. This guy is a fully employed, he works at a car dealership. He's the finance guy there. I mean, this is a upstanding citizen.
If I may correct one thing.
Yes, please.
They were pulled over, and they were never given a ticket for speeding,
okay.
Nothing.
Okay.
The only thing that happened was, so there was never even a speeding ticket involved.
Okay.
And they were leaving the parents' house on the way to their home, basically.
Okay.
Yes.
And Mr. Florence works as the finance guy at a car dealer, or worked as a finance guy at the car dealer.
He's a hardworking man like the rest of us, and he was a finance dealer. He was a young guy.
Yeah.
And he was about, I think, 26 at the time, 27.
So when did they tell him?
But he's a big, you know, he's a tall.
I'm looking at him here. He's a big, handsome guy, well-dressed, and the works. He's in jail now, or he's at the jailhouse. And what happened? How did they get to the strip search, Susan?
Well, you know, it's called processing and intake. So here we go. You know, you get taken in, or he gets taken in. We'll follow his process. And they have a process. You know, they go to their computers that has your full history, you know, your rap sheet. There's no glitches there that you know, they see that he doesn't. He doesn't have a criminal history.
Right. So it's clean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, this warrant did originate from a former arrest when he was younger that was not a felony or anything like that. What happened was it was in the time of racial profiling. As we all know, Mr. Florence is an African-American man.
Okay.
And Jersey does have, you know, a definite racial profiling problem at that time. It was, you know, they signed some kind of settlement agreement to fix it. And he was stopped years earlier, and at the time of racial profiling, what he did is he drove away, actually, on a traffic stop. He was young, and he was scared. And
okay, we got it, but we're years later now, and he's married, and he's working, and he's driving home from his parents' house, and now he's down at the jailhouse, and
in the processing, it basically it goes like this. You walk in, they check you at the computer, fingerprint, picture, and then their process was strip search. They take you in a room with a curtain, and there's a shower, and you're standing, you know, arm's length or a little less from a stranger, a guard, who says, take off all your clothes, turn around, spread your arms, run your fingers through your hair, completely naked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, open your mouth, you know, let me see, you know, stick out your tongue, completely naked. You know, and after all that's done, go into the shower, and, you know, and the officer's sitting there the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And, by the way, in the shower curtain, the curtain that they use isn't really actually closed, so people are walking by. They could look in, officers.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Mr. Florence testified. Then after that process, you go and see a nurse. So it should be the other way around, you know, see the nurse first. If they're really concerned about, you know, lice, which is ridiculous, or, you know, any kind of disease, which, you know, I'm going to the opinion.
But the full strip search is in here somewhere. I mean, he's quoted saying he was told, turn around, squat, and cough, spread your cheeks.
Yes,
the whole thing, he says, it was humiliating, made me feel less than a man, he said.
Yes, and then in Essex had a much harsher strip search. So 6 days later, while he's in jail in Burlington and no one's, you know, acknowledging the fact that he's completely innocent, he gets transferred to Essex, and there, it's their procedure is, you know, they claim they have so many people coming in. They do group strip searches. They take you in a room. People are walking in and out, okay, of this room.
Yep.
You know, guards, other inmates.
Sure.
And they have like five men lined up, and so it's a group strip search, and you take off all your clothes, and that's where they have you squat and cough, which, by the way, is the definition of a body cavity search. So it's not just a strip search.
Though it is standard for strip searches. And that plus, you know, if you're a woman, lift your breasts. If you're a man, lift your genitals. We've got a little tape of your client, Albert Florence, here describing that experience to CNN.
I was just told, just do as you're told. Wash in this disgusting soap and obey the directions of the officer who was instructing me to turn around, lift my genitals up, turn around, squat.
Was your client surprised at what he was asked to do, Susan?
Surprised. He was numbed. He's not the only person I've talked to about this, by the way, but it's a mind-numbing experience, and it's done on purpose to dehumanize you as soon as you walk in, so then you're at their mercy. I mean, once you take off your clothes in front of a stranger and you're told to do all those things, you're basically also, you know, numbed from then on. You know, it's just shut up and do as we say. Which is how Albert explained it as well many times.
You say dehumanize, but the court ruled 5-4 here that the country's jails need this procedure to keep them from turning into places full of contraband.
Yeah, that decision came in a very, you know, political climate of also, you know, plucking Americans and detaining us without any rights. It was also 5-4, which was very, very close. It just seems like a very political motivated decision. And we have Justice Roberts and Alito trying, in their concurring decisions, really trying to smooth this one out. I'm shocked that Justice Kennedy wrote what he wrote, because his famous words of dignity, to me, went the other way around. You know, this is the most undignified way to treat innocent people. And as far as I'm concerned, it's almost like they're saying, well, it's an acceptable risk. So if some innocent people get harmed, it's better at the expense of, 15 other general population people. They shouldn't be putting people like Albert Florence, non-criminal offenders, in with the general population in the first place.
The general jail population. Do you think, in your just experience as a citizen, Susan, walking around, do you think most people understand that, you know, they could be picked up for any of these incredibly minor offenses? And Justice Breyer talked about things that are actually on the record. You know, a noisy muffler, failure to use a turn signal, riding a bicycle without an audible bell. I mean, he cites a nun who was strip searched after an arrest for trespassing during an anti-war demonstration. You know, squat, spread, all this, cough. I mean, do you think Americans understand that walking around the street, this is what they're vulnerable to?
Absolutely not. I think Americans are completely mind-numbed at this point. You know, we've been numbed for the past 10, 12 years. Everyone's afraid to stand up. They know. I mean, people, you know, comment, oh, this is horrible. But, since it didn't happen to them yet, but wait till it happens to them, their mother, their son, their father, then they're going to be all angry. But what they really need to do is get together in Washington.
We're heads up right now. Susan Hannah Lask, joining us there from Fort Lee, New Jersey. Thanks for being with us. We're looking at strip search in America. 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the United States Supreme Court signing off on the strip search of Americans charged with even the most minor of crimes. Failure to use a turn signal, violating a leash law, having a noisy muffler. If they take you into jail for whatever reason, just for a minute while they're looking into that, you, the court says, can be strip searched. And we're not talking just kind of a casual glance here. This is the full deal. Strip, you know, top to bottom, spread, lift, separate, squat, cough, the works. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you think? Does this high court decision make sense to you? Drop them, spread them for even the most minor of offenses. Is the dignity of an American citizen that inconsequential? And can you imagine being out for a Sunday drive, then in a police station, stripped naked, told to squat for forgetting a turn signal? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. The majority opinion written by Justice Anthony Kennedy saying, look, every detainee who will be admitted to the general population may be required to undergo a close visual inspection while undressed. That's kind of a mild way of describing it if you've experienced it. But Justice Kennedy points out that there are 13 million people admitted each year to the nation's jails, and security in those jails, he said, depends on police having this capacity. But there was no requirement here of reasonable suspicion that anybody in particular might be bringing anything into that jail. You can join us today, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Orrin Kerr, professor of criminal law and procedure at George Washington University's School of Law. He's a Fourth Amendment expert, co-author of the leading casebook in criminal procedure. He clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy. He's been watching this case very closely. Orrin Kerr, thanks very much for being here. Welcome back to On Point.
Tom, glad to be back.
Also with us is Eric Luna, professor of law at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia, scholar at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He's followed the case as well and sees some big problems with the ruling. Eric Luna, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Orrin Kerr, first to you. What's the court's logic in coming to this decision?
The court's logic is outside of this one case, and I think it's clear that the system failed in the case of Albert Florence. But outside of this one case, there are 13 million people a year that are brought into jails, and jails are rough and tumble places. And jail administrators certainly don't have to give this kind of close visual inspection of everyone that's brought in. But if they feel it's necessary for running the jail in a safe way, that's a decision that they can make. And the Supreme Court justices, the five justices in the majority, said they weren't going to second-guess jail administrators if those administrators thought it was necessary to strip search everybody upon entering the jail. And I think it's important to realize that from the justices' perspective or from the court's perspective, this case raises very difficult line-drawing problems. And the problem is this. Everyone agrees that dangerous people, really bad, dangerous people, killers and the like, should be strip searched upon entering the jail. And then everybody agrees that in an ideal world, people that pose no threat at all should not be strip searched upon entering the jail. And the really tough question from the standpoint of the law is, how do you draw that line? What's the line that distinguishes the people that raise a risk from people that don't? And what the court decided was that they could not come up with a principled line to draw that distinction, so they were going to defer to the jail administrators.
But, I mean, they don't want to second-guess jail administrators? I think a lot of Americans think of the Constitution as something that defends them from, let's say, jail administrators who want them to strip naked when they are still under a presumption of innocence.
Well, the Fourth Amendment certainly regulates who can be brought to jail, who can be arrested in the first place. So the Fourth Amendment requires probable cause that a crime has been committed and that that particular person committed that crime. And then the question is, what regulates the police beyond that initial Fourth Amendment limitation? And the court held essentially that if the jails want to impose greater restrictions, which many jails do, if they decide it's not worth their time to engage in this sort of a practice, they certainly don't have to engage in this practice. But if the jail administrators decide that a particular jail is so dangerous, or they have had a history of concerns, or for whatever reason they think it's best to have this policy, that the Fourth Amendment does not prohibit it.
I mean, for whatever reason is very important there, because there are many jails where this is automatic procedure. Now, I should point out for our listeners, there are 10 states, 10, in which this is not legal under state law: Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Colorado, Florida, Michigan, Washington. Those 10 states have their own laws on this. Eric Luna, what do you make of this? I just have the gut feeling. I'm no constitutional lawyer, but when I walk around my country, I don't have the sense that I can just be hauled in on some little picayune thing and told to strip, squat, cough, and all the rest. I have a sense of my American citizenship, or just living in this land, entitling me to more dignity, more inviability than that. I guess I'm wrong by this decision.
No, I don't think you're wrong, Tom. I think that's the position that would be taken by the vast majority of Americans. And I think Orrin has done a nice job of describing what was animating the court here. Where I would disagree with the court is on the notion that they could not, in fact, come up with some rules or some principles that would limit the use of strip searches. And I think really what is at the bottom of this is this enormous deference, if not acquiescence, to correctional officials, and which leads to this lowest common denominator applying across the country, that correctional officials don't have to prove that a problem exists, and from what I've seen and what I've read, there is no empirical proof to support the notion that you need to have that these strip searches for minor offenses must be done in order to serve the otherwise valid penological goals.
Or never mind minor offenses. I mean, Justice Breyer wrote that there was a study of 23,000 people admitted to one correctional facility in Orange County, New York, and out of 23,000, there was one instance of contraband detected that wouldn't otherwise have been found without a strip search. One.
Right. And I think that's – and you got to remember that the process involved here. There was, I can imagine, no set of circumstances in which Albert Florence, who was arrested without any prior notice, was immediately taken into custody, in which he could have secreted drugs or weapons or what have you on his body. So it's hard to imagine that circumstance unless you have you've arrested Harry Houdini.
But you acknowledge the threat, presumably. I mean, that we have prisons and jails with millions and millions of people in them. They can be dangerous places. I mean, I'm looking here at one story of an inmate. This was in Florida. This was in a prison, but an inmate, and they found that he had crammed, into his body 17 oxycodone pills, a cigarette, 6 matches, a flint, an empty syringe, a lip balm container, a condom, a CVS receipt. I mean, there is a potential problem here.
Yeah, well, he sounds like a walking 7-Eleven. I acknowledge that this is an issue, and I mean, I've heard of cases where individuals have secreted a cell phone in their anus. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is not, I'm not denying this, but this involves a careful balance. And what you have to remember, you have these searches. I don't think anybody will deny this, that these are humiliating and deeply offensive. And those are the words of Justice Alito in concurrence. And we're having people, they have to spread their buttocks to expose their anus. They have to lift their testicles if they're a man. Or in the case of a woman, they have to squat to expose their vagina. And they have to do this all on command.
And this is with officers then looking into these parts of their body.
That's right. And you've got to remember that we are talking about individuals who have not been convicted of anything. They're presumed innocent. And in this actual case, Mr. Florence was, in fact, innocent. There has been no finding by any judge, no probable cause hearing, nothing except the word of the arresting officer, who is not a neutral magistrate.
Right.
But instead, as Justice Robert Jackson said many years ago, he's in the often competitive enterprise of law enforcement. And so in this case, there's no reason to believe that Albert Florence was involved in a serious or violent crime. In fact, what you have the basis to believe that he committed a civil fine. And given the phenomenon of overcriminalization, this particular ruling will apply, of course, to those who are accused of or believed to have committed homicide, rape, robbery, you name it. But it also applies to those who have committed motor vehicle violations, like failing to wear your seatbelt, parking violations, bicycle violations, those who have violated any one of the myriad ridiculous criminal laws on the books across the nation.
And those aren't just hypothetical. I mean, Justice Breyer himself, in his writing on this, cited examples of people who had been subjected to a strip search after being arrested for driving with a noisy muffler. These are real examples. Failing to use a turn signal, riding a bicycle without an audible bell.
They are real, and you also have to recognize who's going to bear the brunt of this. It's not going to be a Boston Brahmin who's pulled over for speeding in Cambridge. It's going to be the poor, the underclass, the racial minorities. As Albert's counsel mentioned, we have a phenomenon of racial profiling across this country and some other disreputable tactics.
Well, I mean, I take your point right there that is more likely, and it's sad that that's the case. But
right.
With this court ruling, there's no guarantee to that Boston Brahmin or you name it, anybody in this
right.
country.
I'm saying as a practical matter, but I mean, could it apply to, for example, spitting in public places is a misdemeanor in Virginia. So there you go. You could be subject to a strip. I used to live in Salt Lake City. Failing to return library books is a jailable offense.
Again, strip.
Strip. So in the end, the problem with this is the process is the punishment. The most serious consequences these folks will face as a matter of law or practice is not the judgment upon conviction, which is at most likely to be a fine, but having to undergo the degradation of a strip search to begin with.
And what happens if you refuse? You say this requires American citizens to do this on command. I have to say, if I were for some weird reason in there because of one of these incredibly minor things, I would be very resistant to doing this on command, and I would feel just in my bones, raised in this country, that surely the Constitution does not require me to do this.
Right. It raises my back as well. But the reality is, you will be forced to do it. You don't have a choice.
Forced? Like physically forced?
You can bet. You, this is not an optional situation. Now, apparently the federal government, the Bureau of Corrections, does not follow this particular process. And various states, as you mentioned, do not require strip searches.
And many federal appeals courts had said no, unless there's reasonable suspicion of something, no.
That's right. And what this goes to show is not only that that people or states have balked at this, but it's not required. It's not. There's no justification as an empirical matter. You don't have states that have rejected strip searches for minor offenses having this spate of violence and contraband being brought
in their jails.
Into jails.
Eric Luna, please stand by. And Orrin Kerr, it's so good to have you. I want to let our listeners in right here. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to comment on this particular decision and also more broadly on how it relates to the problem the court is facing with regard to the respect and deference it's accorded.
Accorded to jailhouse personnel?
To the Supreme Court.
Oh, I see. Okay.
which is very much in the news this week.
Yeah.
This decision is so radical, I don't think you can even begin to understand it until you look at what the court declined to do. They declined to set out a standard that would have prohibited the strip search of Sister Bernie Galvin. She was a Catholic nun who had been a nun for over 50 years, so she was in her 70s.
Mm-hmm.
She was arrested in 2003 at an anti-war demonstration. She was charged with trespassing, brought to jail, told to remove all her clothes and given a scanty paper hospital-like gown.
A 70-something nun.
Reading room.
Okay.
She refused to submit to a strip search, so they sent her back to the holding room, the cold waiting cell, and said, you can stay there until you submit to the search. So after a couple of hours of freezing, she finally submitted to the search. This court did not think it was capable of devising a standard, even a reasonable person standard, that would have prohibited that kind of a strip search. And now I'd like to turn to the broader issue of when you have a radical court that is giving decisions like this, the respect which it has depended upon for 200 years, which is all it has, as Andrew Jackson famously said, John Marshall has made his ruling, now let him enforce it.
And you mean the respect of the American citizenry to sort of look up and say, yes, that's reasonable, that's our good court.
Mm-hmm. And the co-equal branches of government.
Yep.
The only reason that the President and the Congress follow the dictates of the Supreme Court is because of the respect it's given. These are three co-equal branches of government.
Yeah.
If this Supreme Court gives radical decisions like this, there may come a day when you may have a real constitutional impasse where the other two branches say, I'm sorry, but this is you can go enforce this one on your own.
Never mind citizens themselves. Mark, I appreciate your call. Orrin Kerr, what about that characterization of this court as radical and this issue? I mean, I'm not any branch of the government, but just as a citizen, when I hear this, I feel offended. I feel that I have a native understanding that this is wrong. It does ding my respect for this court.
Well, there's a very easy way out if that is your reaction, and it's a reaction many people will have. And it goes to the caller's point that maybe Congress shouldn't enforce this ruling. This is actually not a ruling that needs to be enforced. In fact, legislatures are perfectly free to impose statutory limitations written by the legislatures that add protection where the courts have said there's no constitutional protection.
But shouldn't we be able to count on the Supreme Court as the respected ultimate arbiter? I mean, we shouldn't have to barricade ourselves against their decision, should we?
The Supreme Court is not in charge of creating good policy. The Supreme Court is in charge of interpreting the Constitution. And there are many contexts in which the Constitution does not indicate what is the right call for the people or what is a popular policy or what is a good policy. So I think it's a critical error to ever think that if something is constitutional, that means it's good. We as voters need to be active and engaged and to say something may be constitutional, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea.
How can we trust that this is a good and pure interpretation of our Constitution when it's 5-4? That means four other justices just simply don't agree. I mean, and we see this again and again, and it makes it hard to look at a decision and say, well, that's what the Constitution says because the court says so. When it's so narrowly divided, it doesn't seem that clear even to this court, Professor Kerr.
Sure, and in fact, many of the most famous criminal procedure decisions that created constitutional rights, Miranda warnings, you have a right to remain silent, that was a 5-4 decision. You could say, how can I believe that there's such a thing as Miranda rights when four justices disagreed with that decision? The truth is, many of the Supreme Court's most important decisions, most influential decisions, have been 5-4 cases. And I don't mean to say that just because the Supreme Court has said something that it's somehow correct. The court often gets cases wrong, and we can criticize the court for it. But I think it's important not to say, I disagree with this one case, therefore I disrespect the court and we should, you know, condemn the court as radicals. This is a genuinely difficult case. And the difficulty is that although we on a show like this can name specific examples of people we know are not dangerous, that were subject to strip searches. The reality is the people administering the jails don't know who's dangerous and who's not.
Something seems wrong to me. Oren Kerr, we appreciate your interpretation right there, and we want to hear more, but please stand by there in Arlington, Virginia, and Eric Luna in Lexington, Virginia, at Washington and Lee University. Listeners, you can join us. We're talking about the Supreme Court ruling this week on strip search. Can you imagine being out for a Sunday drive and ending up like that? Strip, squat, be searched. Do police need this blanket authority to keep jails clear of contraband? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the U.S. Supreme Court signing off this week on the strip search of Americans charged with even the most minor of crimes. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you think? Is this necessary? Does this sound like what the Constitution intends to you? Should the court at least have required some probable cause for concern, some reasonable suspicion? Has this happened to you on a minor offense? Police officers, prison guards, what do you think? And is the high court giving due respect here to the citizenry of this great democracy? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Oren Kerr joins us today. He's professor of criminal law and procedure at George Washington University's School of Law. Fourth Amendment expert Eric Luna is with us from Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia, scholar at the Cato Institute, libertarian outfit there. And you can join us right here, 800-423-8255. Jesse in Litchfield, South Carolina. Thanks for calling, Jesse. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. My point is that I guess no one plans to get arrested, and so it seems awfully absurd to assume the worst about everyone that gets a traffic violation and whatnot. And I think that as citizens, we are obligated to abide by the law, but as law enforcers, they're obligated to assess every situation and analyze the risk.
You mean people don't get expect to get arrested, so they're not likely to be walking or driving around with something secreted in a body cavity?
Exactly, and certainly not coming from their, you know, parents from dinner. I mean, I think that there's an analysis of every scenario that obviously we can't make a blanket assessment of everybody, and laws tend to do that. I guess I don't know. Where the law should lie, you know?
Well, the Supreme Court gave us their opinion this week, 5-4, and we'll continue to look at that. Let me get another here. Thank you, Jesse. John in Nashville. What do you think, John? Hello, John?
Hey, it's been many years, back into the 70s, since I've seen the inside of an American jail.
Okay.
But at that time, strip searching was common. I don't believe that anyone entered the jail in San Francisco without being strip searched. It's kind of a rite of passage for an American citizen who's in the underclass or a racial minority or, say, against the war in Vietnam. So the outrage amongst white middle-class people about this practice is kind of amusing, actually. It's just been common practice for so long. And frankly, it's necessary.
Even if it's a turn signal, a broken turn signal, you think is necessary?
Yes, I do. It's a democratizing thing for one thing. Everybody who crosses that threshold is treated the same way. Whether you're rich, poor, black, white, you bend over. That's just the way it is.
Boy, John, I hear you, though it's not my sense of what U.S. citizenship ought to mean, though I take your point about how it may be seen as a rite of passage by some. Eric Luna, I'm reading here, this is Bernard Harcourt. He's at the University of Chicago, legal scholar there. And he writes the day of the decision. He says, today's Supreme Court decision on strip searches is alarming. He says that the decision reflects, quoting him here, the kind of logic that can turn a democracy into a police state. And he says he doesn't believe he's being hyperbolic. He said, you know, that's a logic that seeks to eliminate, to absolutely eradicate and purge any and all security risks, no matter how small they might be, demands total suppression and erasure of risk, and is willing to do anything relative to people's rights or dignity in order to bring that about. What do you think, Professor Luna?
Oh, I agree with Bernard. I think he probably hit it on the head. I'm of the opinion, and your last caller, he raised a decent point, but just because the prison authorities have said it's necessary doesn't mean that it is, in fact, necessary. I agree with what Oren said. Something that is poor policy doesn't mean that it's unconstitutional. But at the same time, just because prison authorities say that they have to do it, I don't think that means that it's constitutional. And when you're dealing with the type of intrusion here, hyper intrusion into individual privacy, I think you actually have to come up with something. If you're going to make a claim that has an empirical underpinning, then you have to show that that's in fact true. And in this case, the corrections officials didn't do so. They haven't shown that they need to do this. Certainly, they make good arguments about what could happen. Given what I've seen, that's not in fact supported by the empirics. And again, I understand the argument is deference, and the argument is that the courts are in a poor position to be able to make these types of judgments. They can't hold congressional hearings and gather evidence. They're not an executive agency.
But deference to jail administrators, that just seems, I mean, wasn't this country born out of thinking about dungeons and everything that can go on there, and not in respect to dungeon keepers, but in respect to freedom.
Right. And I think this is this is a country that should where the government should be limited, that there are in fact boundaries as to what they do. The fact that government says that it is necessary doesn't mean that it in fact is necessary. And in this environment, when you have these types of clashes between, in this case, the prison industry and those who are concerned about individual liberties, the court does have a role to play. I agree with Oren that at some point this is something that can be dealt with legislatively. It certainly can be done by administrative rule of the individual prisons and jails. But in a federal form of government in which we live, there will still be places that will not adopt more reasonable rules. And the question is whether that should be tolerated given the intrusiveness of the search and the lack of a verified empirical basis for this type of intrusion.
Oren Kerr, questions from our listeners here online. Yosha asks, one, how will this ruling affect minors? Can 14-year-old girls arrested for marijuana possession now be strip-searched? Professor Kerr?
I would imagine not, because they generally would not be introduced into the general population of the jail. And that actually brings up an important limitation on this case. The Supreme Court's ruling is limited to individuals that are introduced into the general population of the jail, and that raises the security concerns of bringing contraband into the jail or weapons into the jail. If somebody is not brought into the general population of the jail, this opinion does not apply. And in fact, it looks like that limitation was necessary to get to the 5-justice majority. At least there's two concurring opinions, one by the Chief Justice, the other by Justice Alito. And Justice Alito's opinion says it's important to realize this opinion does not apply outside to individuals that are not brought into the general population. So in the case, first we have to have not only somebody who's ticketed.
And when you say into the general population, you mean they're not just in the jailhouse, but they're put behind bars where the general prison population is, or jail population.
So in the event that somebody, a minor, is arrested, they generally, my understanding at least, is that they would not be introduced into the general population of the adult jail. They'd be brought to an individual holding cell until they're released. So if they're brought to a special individual holding cell not released into the general population of the prison, this rule would not apply.
Let's go to Sandra in Penlaird, Virginia. Sandra, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
I'd like to know what the ramifications are of this for free speech in this country. Frankly, as someone who is considered an animal welfare activist,
okay,
and who has friends who have demonstrated against the Keystone Pipeline, Dominion Power here in Virginia, as well as other environmental issues, and who have actually been hauled off in paddy wagons and gone through the routine of you pay your $100, you get handcuffed, and then you come home.
Yeah.
What does this mean for them? Is this going to shut all these people up? I mean, it's a very, very intimidating thing. What happened to innocent till proven guilty? Why I object to the searches that I and my husband, who has a medical device, have to go through every time we get on an airplane. But, I don't fly anymore if I can possibly drive anywhere.
Sandra, let me ask you, though.
They can do this with no warrant, no suspicion.
Yeah, but what about safety in the jail? I mean, you on the airplane, you know why they're looking, at least. What about the safety in jails? People smuggle all kinds of stuff in there.
Well, no. I absolutely, unless you have reason to do this, if you're dealing with a 55-year-old woman who is at a demonstration for against the Keystone Pipeline.
Yeah.
I really don't think this is someone without other cause, a record, that people like this should be strip searched.
Sandra, we've got it. Let me bring Eric Luna. Let me put it to you. And here's another online. Michigan writes to us: the most insidious aspect of this ruling is that it will intimidate the average citizen from exercising their First Amendment right to freedom of assembly, as many will fear the possibility of a humiliating strip search. And you hear that concern from Sandra, Eric.
Yeah, I do. And you got to remember, a previous caller mentioned Sister Bernie Galvin.
Mm-hmm. The nun, 70-something, who was strip searched.
That's right. Well, she was arrested for trespassing during an anti-war demonstration. So is there the possibility that there will be some free speech assembly implications here? Sure. And in particular, given that it doesn't mean that there aren't other provisions in the Constitution, the First Amendment, that might be relevant. But the Fourth Amendment, as a matter of interpretation by the Supreme Court, doesn't look into the subjective motivations of individual officers.
Mm-hmm.
So you will not be questioning whether, in fact, they were arrested because they were protesting, were taken to jail instead of released on their own cognizance because they were protesting. They'll have to find some other basis. And I think somebody should be concerned about the chilling effect that a ruling like this might have.
Let's go to Mike in Watertown, New York. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, what do you know?
Well, I'm a 30-year prison employee in New York State, and the problem with this whole thing is not the court's ruling, it's what got the individual there to begin with.
A broken turn signal, let's say, Justice Breyer cited, or riding a bicycle without an audible bell.
Incarceration.
What?
It does not rise to incarceration. As an employee of the state, myself and my staff have an inherent responsibility to protect the integrity of the inside of that institution.
But some people have gone to jail. Justice Breyer was citing it for exactly that kind of infraction, Mike.
That's what the problem is, Tom. It's not the ruling of the court of the strip searches. The problem is what got the people there.
Do you mean that they shouldn't have had that broken bicycle bell, or they shouldn't have been brought to jail for it?
They should have been given an appearance ticket. Your ticket, go see the judge, be on your way. That's not something that rises to incarceration.
Mike, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Aaron Kerman, I was thinking the same thing here. You know, Justice Kennedy cited 13 million people admitted each year to the nation's jails, and you got this tidal wave coming in, and how are you going to keep control and some security in these jails? I mean, maybe part of the issue is bigger here than the strip search issue. Maybe we're just putting too many people in jail, even briefly. You know, if it gets to the point where you can't guarantee the dignity of our citizenry because you're putting so many people through jail, maybe there's something bigger wrong here.
I think the caller is right that the critical question is who gets sent to jail, not what happens at the jail. And so it is true that there have been examples of people sent to jail as part following an arrest for extremely minor crimes. Fortunately, that's relatively rare. It's something I think most of us would say shouldn't happen at all. If it's truly a minor offense, as the caller suggested, they should receive a ticket. And I think the real focus should be on when do people get to jail, more than the question of exactly what the search should be upon arriving at jail. And I don't want to minimize this question, but it's important to realize that we're looking at this case, which is one question, which is part of a broader framework, which is what should be a crime, who should be charged with a crime, who should be arrested if they've committed a crime, who should be sent to the jail, and then what should happen at the jail. And this is part of a big, broader picture. And I think the caller is right to bring up that probably the easiest way to fix this problem is not as much at the constitutional question at the jail, but at the question of who gets brought to the jail in the first place.
Boy, but you know, in this country, even when I'm taken to jail, I don't think of my dignity just flying out the window. You've got the American Bar Association in this case with a brief that they filed saying, you know, this American strip search policy now violates international human rights treaties. I mean, here in our country, Eric Luna, the Chief Justice Roberts, wrote about not wanting to embarrass the future. Now, he signed off on this. He was one of the 5-4 majority. But what was he talking about when he cautioned on embarrassing the future?
Well, it may be some of the things you just mentioned, that this will be come to be seen as a mistake, given fuller knowledge of the interests involved and giving the changing perception as well as reality of incarceration in the United States. I think that there is also a concern, and I agree with the caller. I agree with Professor Kerr about the problem. The problem in the first instance is the amount of behavior or conduct that is criminalized, such that virtually everyone is a potential offender and a potential prisoner or jailee. Nonetheless, there is that issue that remains. What happens when someone is, in fact, taken into lockup? And although this was not part of it, Oren correctly mentioned that this is about being those who are going to go into a general population, I think that actually begs the question, which is, should these individuals be going into general population? Again, they have not been convicted of anything. Mm-hmm. They're going to be mixed with individuals who have. And although that wasn't an issue here, and although that's been passed on by the courts before, I still think that that's a very difficult question. And many states are appropriately, as well as the federal system, appropriately segregate those who have been convicted from those who are presumed innocent and are to be protected against the general population.
Oren Kerr, we just got half a minute here, but are you worried about this issue of respect and deference to the court with a decision like this, that Americans, American institutions, the other branches of government start to look and say, what's going on over there?
You know, I think it's important for everyone to be following what the Supreme Court's doing, because so many of its cases are important. And I think it's interesting to compare this case with the healthcare cases that we've heard argument on. Interestingly, the deference issue seems to cut politically the other way, and certainly based on the oral argument last week, the justices are sort of crossing the directions they were in this Fourth Amendment case. So it's something we should be watching.
Well, eyes wide open, and good luck to us all. Oren Kerr at George Washington University's School of Law. It's always good to talk with you. Thank you for joining us today.
Glad to join you.
And Eric Luna at Washington and Lee University. Thank you very much for being here, Professor Luna.
Thanks for having me.
Good luck, everybody. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.